From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, a conversation with Eric Idle. His new memoir, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, reveals a life committed to comedy in TV, musical theater, and movies, but it's all tied together by the troupe Monty Python and funded with a little help from friends.
Python always pleased itself. We always decided what to do, but we've never have made the Holy Grail but for rock and roll. I mean, it was Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Genesis, Jethro Tull. They all chipped in money so we could make the film.
And Brazilian jazz singer Luciana Souza turns the poems of Leonard Cohen into song. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
And by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards, including Lead Actress Olivia Colman, Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, and Best Picture of the Year, awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. As we ease into the week, we'll start today with someone whose career spans television, film, music, and theater, and connecting it all is a clever take on British society.
Good morning. I'd care to purchase a chicken, please.
Don't come here with that posh talk, you nasty stuck-up twit.
I beg your pardon?
A chicken, sir, certainly. Here
Thank
we are.
You. And how much does that work out to per pound, my good fellow?
Per pound, you slimy trollop. What kind of a ponce are you?
I'm sorry?
4 and 6 a pound, sir. Nice and ready for roasting.
Monty Python was formed in 1969 by Graham Chapman, Terry Gilliam, John Cleese, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and the guest on our show today, Eric Idle. He has a new memoir titled Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, named for the song in the Python film Life of Brian. In the book, Idle reflects on his career, his famous friends, of which there are many, and the origins of Python's absurd but pretty brainy brand of humor. Idle was raised in post-war England by a single mother. He attended boarding school where pervasive bullying taught him that humor could be a form of self-defense.
I don't think it's a conscious decision. I think it's just a weapon that you develop and that you unconsciously use to protect yourself. And then I would learn to just let go and not censor what I was thinking. And then people would laugh. And that's still true.
Do you think there was a moment where you, as a comedian, and maybe with your collaborators, figured out that you could tell jokes about serious issues? That just because you were addressing something that was maybe meaningful, it didn't mean it had to be serious. That you could make fun of politicians, you could make fun of the church.
That was the satire boom did that for us first when we were growing up. Beyond the Fringe did that. But I think when you look at what Python tackled, I don't think we did too badly. We know we tackled the Holy Grail legend, we tackled religion, and we tackled the meaning of life.
I am dead.
Yes, well, the thing is, we've got some people from America for dinner tonight.
Who is it, darling?
It's a Mr. Death or something. He's come about the reaping. I don't think we need any at the moment.
Hello.
Python started in 1969, so in a year, you will be marking your 50th anniversary. And something you say in the book, which I thought was fascinating, is that you said there have been probably more hours spent documenting Monty Python than there were hours of Python programming. And I'm wondering, in some way, conscious or unconscious, this book is a corrective to some of the narratives about Monty Python that you thought weren't quite right. Is this setting the record straight, even if it's your record?
I think there is no record. I think everybody has a different view of what's going on all the time. And that we have no way of understanding what somebody else is thinking and perceiving what's going on, even in this very interview, because we can't read each other's thoughts. But I did want to put my story down and how I see it and how I looked at it before I forgot. I think with especially a group of 6 people, each one will have a different view of what went on that day.
Did they have different views of your account of what happened that day? Did they say, after maybe they saw early copies of the book, that was you, not me, who did that thing? Or
there's very few factual things have crept in now after all these years and so much documentation. I think it's more like interpretation. I mean, I had dinner with John Cleese the other night, and he said he laughed a lot. He was reading the book. He meant to read 3 pages. He said he found he'd read 30 pages and needed to go to bed because he was too interested. I think Michael got a bit grumpy because I outed him as being a bit cross at a certain stage in his life. But he had glossed over that in his own you know, diaries. Think about a diary. If you write a diary, you're the star of it.
Right. How do you remember so much? Did you take notes or did certain people say, remember the time that that rock promoter gave you the large bag of cocaine and you put it under the table? Or those memories indelible, those incidents?
I think when you sit down to start thinking about what happened and then you write various things that amuse you or you're stuck in your mind, I think that's when they come out. And then I would have an editor who was my agent who would say, that's too inside baseball. You know, sometimes about the business stuff. So leave that out because you don't really know what part of your life is interesting. You want to shape the book so it's about something. So when I discovered finally after three or four drafts that the book was actually about my generation, people growing up post-war in England with rationing and poor, and that these kids who were born in the end of the war, they invented rock and roll. It was like a renaissance happened in the 60s and they sort of reinvented Britain.
Did you feel that there were some things that were off limits? Did you have to either change or omit facts to protect the guilty?
I went to Steve Martin, who's a very smart and intelligent man, who wrote a lovely book called Born Standing Up. And I said, Steve, what were your guidelines? What advice would you give? And he said, what I did was, if I remembered something, I would only write about things that were good about people. And I think that was a very good bit of advice.
A lot of people, when they think of Monty Python and your work, they think of films like Life of Brian or The Holy Grail. I want to talk about a different film for a minute. Let's listen to this movie.
What do you want?
The pirate Yellowbeard is due to be released in 2 days, and despite years of unpleasantness, he's still told us nothing of the treasure he's hidden. However, I have a detailed plan here.
I doubt if she could manage more than the label on a gin bottle. Just tell us.
A lot of people don't know this movie. It's a 1983 film called Yellowbeard, and you write in your book, quote, I've often found that bad movies are more fun to be on than good ones.
Invariably.
Why is that?
Well, it's a very good question. Sometimes when you're making good work, you don't have enough money, and it's uncomfortable, and it's difficult and muddy and horrible, like The Holy Grail. It turns out to be very good in the end because we didn't have enough. So you're inventing all the time. When you make a film which is like Yellowbeard, where they brought every single living, breathing comedian down to Mexico to be in it, one of the great funs was being on location with Peter Cook. He would just make me laugh all day. Marty Feldman would make me laugh. So you were just within a group of clowns. And that was good, despite the fact the film was always rubbish. You know, the script was never good. Graham was great, but he wasn't a very good writer. He was an alcoholic, and if you added him with Peter Cook and Bernard McKenna, three alcoholics wrote that film.
Coming up, why Eric Idle and the rest of the Pythons turned to George Harrison and other rock stars to fund their movies. To find, explore.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite. Nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Screenplay and Best Picture of the Year. Also nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Best Picture, and one of AFI's 10 Best Pictures of the Year, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Let's get back to my conversation now with Eric Idle. He has a new memoir which recalls his career in TV, film, and music. Idle wrote and directed the mockumentary The Ruddles, All You Need Is Cash, which is a parody of the Beatles. And actually, George Harrison appears in the film as an interviewer. We'll pick up my conversation now with Eric Idle talking about his friendship with the late Beatle, George Harrison.
His friendship meant an enormous amount to me because I was going through a broken marriage at the time, and he was very encouraging and friendly and supportive. And I would go out to his house in Henley, and we'd play guitars. And in terms of Python, He paid for the life of Brian in its entirety. He mortgaged his house and put it down to make a movie. I mean, imagine what he says to the wife in the morning. You know, hello, love, I've just mortgaged the house. I'm going to put it on this film over here.
If he didn't write that check, the movie doesn't get made?
We tried to sell it here in America. We went through to New York, we went to L.A., and it was like selling Springtime for Hitler. They looked at us with jaws open. You must be mad. And I think part of the reason it got made was because Dennis O'Brien, who was George's bad, he looked after his money and everything, thing, intended it to lose money. It was actually the producers. It was supposed to be a film so awful it would never make money, so it was a tax write-off.
It
was, exactly. And the trouble was it made money, so they had to change it immediately.
What is your name, Jew?
Brian, sir.
Brian, eh?
No, Brian.
Ow! So, you dare to wait us?
To what, sir?
Strike him, Centurion, very roughly.
So I think Python always pleased itself. We always decided what to do, but we'd never have made the Holy Grail but for rock and roll. I mean, it was Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Genesis, Jethro Tull. They all chipped in money so we could make the film. And the good news about them is they didn't want the money back. It was only about 10,000 quid each. And they don't care and they don't interfere and they don't say, oh, no, there should be a scene over here with somebody with another head. So they're the best backers. And it wasn't until we made The Meaning of Life that we actually went to a studio, because it was now $10.5 million to raise. And we were running out of rich rock stars. So that was made by the Universal Studios.
The other thing that I found fascinating is that George Harrison and the Beatles were actually very fond of the Ruttles.
From these streets, very close to the cavern Rutland, came the fabulous Rutland sound, created by the Prefab Four, Dirk, Nasty, Stig, and Barry, who created a musical legend that will last a lunchtime. Their first album was made in 20 minutes. The second took even longer. Tonight, we examine the legend of the Ruttles. We look at their lives, their loves, their music. We examine some of the problems that made them what they are today. And we shall also be asking some of the people who worked with them whether they were really the sort of lovable people they were made out to be.
They had a good sense of humor about themselves and about that film.
Well, George is in it.
Yes.
He's actually in it. But he also very much encouraged me. And he showed me this film called The Long and Winding Road, which was an assembly that Apple, the Beatle Apple, had put together. But they couldn't agree how to release it, because they all bicker towards the end and everybody looks bad. And so they never released it. But most of that stuff eventually came out in anthology. But my film of the Ruttles is a parody of a film that was never released.
A lot of your book is about the people you've met, the projects you've done. But there are also moments where you talk about your personal life, about your marriage. Been married how long now?
41 years with my current, yes.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
But you also talk about stepping out of public life, about moving to France. Why were those things important to include?
Because that's more me. Most of my life is actually spent in a little room writing or just reading or being quiet. You know, it isn't a big show business life. At certain times, we met very interesting people and I write about them. But actually, my favorite thing to do is to get away completely and be in the country and read and write and think and walk, you know, and eat, because it's France.
There are so many boldface names in this book, but there's some people who not a lot of people might have heard of or recognize. And there's a name that appears in the second half of the book. Before we talk about him, let's hear a song from The Meaning of Life called Galaxy Song.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power.
So who is John Dupre?
John Dupre is my collaborator. I met him first on The Life of Brian when we wrote a song called The Otto Song, which got cut. He plays on Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. He plays trumpet. But we collaborated since then, and eventually we made Spamalot. We wrote Spamalot, the musical, and won the Tony for Best Musical of the Year in 2005. So I dragged him off on Round the Road, on tours. We were just doing one in England. I just did a Q&A thing, you know, and he came up and played. And we played selections from a show I made him work on for 3 years called Death the Musical.
A comedy.
A comedy. Absolutely. To me, it was a shoo-in. But people said, you're out of your mind.
I'm going to talk about Spam a lot. And I'm going to play a song that is probably my favorite song from the musical because of what it accomplishes. It's called The Song That Goes Like This.
Now we can go straight into the middle eight. A bridge that is too far for me.
I'll sing it in your face while we both embrace, and then we change the key.
What I love about this song is that you are working within the genre as you're making fun of the genre itself. And I think in a direct line, this musical inspired the Book of Mormon. But I'm wondering, how early do you figure out within a movie, within a song, within a TV show, that you can take the conventions of the thing that you're working in, respect them, and also ridicule them at the same time?
I think it was necessary because it's what Python always did. We always like, we're making a movie in Holy Grail, something blows over and says, it's only a model. You know, we break the fourth wall. We recognize in a book, we recognize it's a book. So it was important for me when adapting this to make it recognize that it was in itself a musical. And then you get a nice area where you just, well, we're all conspiring to make believe in this. So, and we are now making a movie of it. So that's another whole set of different issues where you're not just doing a stage musical, you're going to put it out there on a film.
I'm going to play another song from Meaning of Life. This is a song about the Roman Catholic Church.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
I just want to say you are laughing at your own song.
Well, because I didn't write it. Okay. It's Michael Palin wrote that with Terry Jones, and I love it. I actually got to sing it at O2, and Arlene Phillips, who did choreograph the film, she came and choreographed the stage show. So it was really great.
Was there ever a moment in a song like this where people said, you have gone too far, you're going after the Roman Catholic Church, you're, you know, talking about reproduction, you're talking about sperm. Did everything you want to do get seen, or there's some things that where they just said, you can't do that?
Well, by and large, they didn't. Nobody had the power to stop us doing what we wanted. Even right from the beginning, when the BBC washed their hands and said, oh, just do what you want, you know. When we made even this film, which was made for Universal, we wouldn't give them the script. So they said, well, what do you want? He said, well, the budget's 10.12 million, and here's a 12-line poem that I've written. Call this everything that's everything in this movie, everything that fits from the meaning of life in the universe to girls with great big. And it went on and on, this very low, low poem. And they greenlit the film on the poem and the budget because we took the view, how are they going to tell us how to make a Python film?
Right.
Because we didn't know.
For people who don't know, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, I think, is the most popular song at British funerals. When you think about not just that song, but Monty Python's legacy and your work, does it feel like you set out what you wanted to do?
I think we would be completely amazed if after even 4 weeks working on the show, you'd said it would be on next year. I think well, one thing we were completely agreed on is it would never work in America. And 50 years later, it's still all over Netflix. You know, you go, well, look at this. This is amazing. And that's where all the documentaries are. I found two I hadn't seen. There was one in black and white about the early years of the Pythons. And I'm watching this and I think, I don't remember this at all.
You've written your book. What do you work on now? And are you as excited to sit down and start working on something now as you were 40, 50 years ago?
Yes, I always wait until I finished a project and then think, well, what do I want to do next? In this case, we're slightly pushed because the movie has its own momentum, and I have to do the script, but also make sure we get good, funny people in.
That's important.
I think so.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Eric Idle's sort of biography is called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Eric, thanks so much for coming in.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Coming up, singer Luciana Souza says reading and writing poetry can be an act of resistance.
And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. When Brazilian singer Luciana Souza moved to the United States in the early 1980s, she didn't speak much English. At first, Souza focused on Brazilian jazz and wordless music. Later, her catalog expanded to include experimental jazz, classical, and chamber music. In 2007, she won a Grammy for her participation in Herbie Hancock's album River, The Joni Letters. And now she applies her wide musical palette to poetry, adapting poems to original melodies. She spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett recently about her latest album called The Book of Longing. It's dedicated mainly to the poems of Leonard Cohen, who is also a close family friend.
I'm Luciana Souza, and I'm a Brazilian jazz singer.
Por ser de lá do sertão.
Poetry has always been with me. My mother was a poet and lyricist, and the thing I remember most about our household is many, many instruments lying around. People would come through town and leave things in corners, bags with things in it, you know, percussion, an old guitar, and books, many, many, many books. My mother was a voracious reader and loved reciting poetry. So in amidst the fight that we would have, we're five siblings, I'm the youngest, she would stop us by going into some kind of poem by a Brazilian poet, Carlos Drummond de Andrade, Cora Coralina, these great Brazilian poets. She would just sort of startle us, and then the fighting would stop.
Me ame devagarinho, sem fazer nenhum esforço. Tô doido por teu carinho, pra sentir aquele gosto que você tem na maçã.
I have to say, I was not an educated musician when I came to the United States. I was 18, I went to Berkeley, I could barely speak English, really. So I kind of left words for a long time, and I was really interested in wordless music and singing along with instruments, doubling lines. But then once I became more comfortable with that, then I felt like I could go back to poetry. And also I think after I came to LA, I married Larry Klein, who's a record producer and bass player. He's, again, like my mom, an avid reader and loves poetry and was really good friends with Leonard Cohen. And, you know, I find that that also helps me arrive at this moment with this recording. So one day Larry, my husband, brings home this book. And it's one of these things that I just kind of carried around and it was in the car with me and I was going here and there and going on the road and carrying it around. And I just loved the, there's a drawing of Leonard's on the front. So I love the cover. And the first poem in the book is The Book of Longing, and it's just remarkable. I think there is a sense of rhythm in his poetry, and that's what attracts me to it.
I can't make the hills, the system is shot. I'm living on pills for which I thank God. I follow the course from chaos to art. Desire, the horse, the pression, the cart.
When I set a poem to music, it's always the same. I start by falling in love, you know, with it, and then I memorize it. And then I walk around and it becomes a part of me. And then I think it's mine. I really fool myself into thinking I wrote this, because I kind of have to, in order to take the liberties that I need to take. And so I just repeat a line a few times, and then my hands kind of sit at the piano in a certain way, and then a rhythm comes, and then melody comes. And I find that the most primordial thing that we have, the most primary thing that we have in life is rhythm. It's the walking that we do, it's, right, it's the breathing that we do. We are commanded by that every day, every second. I ended up setting seven of these poems to music, and I went to Leonard and asked him if I could continue and maybe make a recording of it, and he declined very politely. He said no, and I was devastated. But they stayed with me, and I didn't go any further because I knew that maybe this would be an impossible project, and I didn't want to fall in love with it and then be disappointed over and over again. But I ended up asking when I did my record in 2015 called Speaking in Tongues. It was a record all wordless, no words at all. But I had these two poems that I really thought would fit so well on the record. And I asked him again, and this time he said yes.
I've worked at my work. I've slept at my sleep. have died at my death and now I can leave.
When Leonard passed away, it was as if a family member had died. He had been at our wedding. And I mean, it's just, you know, I felt close to him because I so admired him. But it was quite sad. And for Larry, of course, it was devastating. But it's losing more than the friend, I think, for us also, for artists, is losing that voice, that lucid voice. I mean, his last record is brilliant, and you just keep hoping that folks like that would keep putting out music and poetry so you can keep lifting yourself through that and learning through him. So it's sad on so many levels.
Now that my mission has come to its end, pray I'm forgiven the life that I've led.
Poetry to me, sometimes it's almost an act of resistance, like personally. So it's not that my poems are political, but the first song on the record called These Things, it's not a poem about love, which some of the other poems on the record are, but it's a poem about, to me, about the state of things right now. We carry flags, we say things, but what are these things that we're doing?
These are the duties of the heart.
I also think that the act of just being contemplative and just being reflecting and reflexive about the world around you and taking just time to read something and to see what that does to you is an act of resistance right now, because the world is incredibly loud and fast-paced in a way that the velocity of things is overwhelming to all of us. So sitting with one poem for a few minutes, or one song, or one record, the act of concentration that's required to read poetry and to listen to poetry is an act of resistance nowadays, because it brings you inward.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Or somewhere.